All right, let's begin. Medicine and Morals, lesson number 6. Everyone's got a book. That's good. Okay, so let's take a look at the review questions for lesson 6. All right, on the handout, review question number 1 is, what is one way that Jewish law seeks to protect the welfare of the mentally ill? Hold on, so who was here last week? Just you, Fred? Aren't you weren't here last week? So that's it, just me and you.
Appointing a guardian,
very good. What are the parameters of what a guardian may do on behalf of one who is incapable of making his or her own decisions? What is the overarching charge that we give the guardian? What are you allowed to do? What are you not allowed to do? There you go, 2 for 2. You're knocking them out of the park. It's got to be for the direct benefit of the one who the decision is being made on behalf of. What are the obligations of one suffering from mental illness with regard to Torah and mitzvot? Are they obligated in Torah and mitzvot?
To the extent of one's ability.
Very good. Very good. In other words, there's no definite rule. Whatever a person is able to understand and learn and practice, that would be within their realm of obligation. And we talked also about the value of inclusion, even if somebody is not obligated in any area of Torah mitzvot, just because they're not able to have that obligation, and we don't hold somebody obligated to something that they just can't do. On the other hand, there is value in inclusion in whatever way possible within the Jewish community. Okay, so now we get to lesson 6. Lesson 6 is a very important lesson. Huh?
I really marked it down.
Yeah, you do get an A. Lesson 6 is very important. The title of the class is Secret Code, Genetics and the Ethics of Patient Confidentiality. With the advance of medical science, the rules of the game have changed. Today, doctors know, or may know, a lot more about us than was... Not may, they pretty much do know more about us than has ever been known before in the history of humankind. And specifically vis-a-vis genetic information, we've been able to unlock many secrets that one might not be able to see with the naked eye. Various genetic diseases, illnesses, whatever it is, ranging from something that could be debilitating to something that you're just a carrier for, genetic testing can come up with these things. The wrinkle with genetics is that it's not only a personal issue. It also affects family. Because if it's genetic, then it can affect siblings, children, etc. So, when it comes to genetics, questions arise as with regards to confidentiality. Not the question of, is a doctor obligated to share the information with the patient? That is certain. The question is about confidentiality. May a doctor share confidential information, genetic information, with a family member or not, according to secular law, according to Jewish law? What if that information can protect somebody else? I'll give you a simple example. Somebody comes to a doctor. Doctor does some tests. The husband, let's say he's a husband, is HIV positive. He's married. What are the responsibilities of the doctor to the wife? Or are there none? Is the doctor allowed to call up the wife and say, hey, Rebbetzin's Mrs. So-and-so, you might want to know this piece of information we just discovered about your husband. Is the doctor allowed to do that? Is the doctor charged to do that? Is the doctor not allowed to do that? A psychiatrist. You got somebody on the couch. I don't know if psychiatrists use couches. And it comes out in the process of treatment, in the process of analysis, that this individual has homicidal thoughts about an ex-girlfriend and has very vivid ideas about killing this woman. And you're the psychiatrist. Simple question. What are your responsibilities with regard to this information? On the one hand, confidentiality. You got to protect the interests of your patient. Hey, good to see you. You got to protect the interests of your patient. And if Dina, there's a book in the front of the table if you want to grab one. So you can. So on the one hand, the doctor is bound, and we're going to speak about all of these issues in according to U.S. law and Jewish law. On the one hand, the doctor is bound, perhaps, to the patient. You can't divulge personal information. On the other hand, it's not just personal information. It affects third party, whether it's wife, whether it's ex-girlfriend, yeah, HIV-positive situation, or homicidal thought. So what do we say about confidentiality? What are the obligations? What are the prohibitions with regard to doctors and maybe even attorneys, lawyers, with regard to the information that is shared with them, but that others might need to know for their own benefit? How do you balance all that? And of course, cannot teach this class without addressing the huge WikiLeaks issue that's been brewing lately, because here we're talking about documents, classified, secret. What was the language? No foreign. I gotta get you covered. So what do you say about that? Here you have all these documents. They're leaked. Is it legal? Is it illegal? What does Jewish law say? What does halacha mandate? What's the issues? So let's break everything down like a good old NFL pregame show. Let's break it all down. All right, I'm going to channel my inner Terry Bradshaw. All right, let's do it. Let's begin with a case study. Case study is tremendous. Page 188. Fred, take it away.
Jim, 60, has recently been diagnosed with Huntington's disease. There is no reported family history of HD, but in retrospect, several of his deceased relatives may also have had the condition. He has expressed a view, strongly shared with his wife Mary, that he does not want any of their four children, aged 27 to 37 years, to be informed of the diagnosis nor of the risk to them. Jim and Mary can only see negative consequences arising out of the sharing of such information and anticipate that they will be blamed, Mary says. They either have it or they don't.
So parents, not only patient, not only Jim, but Mary as well says, no reason to share with the kids. Either they have it or they don't. Continue.
Couple has been advised by genetic staff that their children might in fact want to know so they can make their own choices. They have been offered help in communicating with their children, but have declined. The staff case discussion, most health professionals on the team feel that Jim and Mary's confidentiality should be respected. Justification for this decision is based on the lack of effective treatment for HD. Nevertheless, concern is also expressed that the children have a right to know what they are actually at risk of.
So the dad is diagnosed with Huntington's disease. It has no cure. There are no treatments for it. The children may be at risk.
It's a genetic
disease. The children may be at risk. Jim and his wife say, and Mary say, no, let's not tell the kids. They're adult, they're not children, they're 27 to 37. Don't tell the kids. Now the ethicists are debating. The hospital staff is debating. Most say, let's respect their wishes. Some say, the children have a right to know. Why? Because Jim's genetic information is not only his. It's relevant to perhaps the children. So how do you deal with this? What do you think? So I'll ask you the question. Learning activity number one. Should the healthcare professionals respect Jim and Mary's wishes? Why or why not? Defend your view like a Maccabee. What do you think?
We're sort of the ethics of it, not the legality.
Throw me both. Throw me whatever you have.
Well, under the U.S. law, you can't do it.
You can't?
Cannot do it.
You're not allowed to share information?
No. I mean, you know, medical information is kept very private.
Okay. Under all circumstances?
It'd be pretty extreme, but something like this would.
So you, okay. So there are cases, which we'll talk about, where not only is one allowed to, but one is obligated to by U.S. law to divulge. Simple case, if a medical professional sees signs of child abuse or spousal abuse, has to be reported.
And your psychiatrist's example, if he's an imminent threat, then you have to tell.
Okay, good. So in this case, you don't see it in the same way.
No.
It's a deadly disease?
It's not an imminent threat to anybody.
Right. There's no definitive proof that the children will have a problem.
Okay, so the argument is that it's not a clear and present danger because you don't know, it's an unknown. But maybe if it was known, it could be evaluated, but even if it is evaluated, you're saying it's still not imminent because it is what it is.
And even if they knew, you can't do anything about it.
Ah, so even if you knew, so in, as opposed to a case of murder and spousal abuse where if you know, you can do something about it here, even if you know, you can't do anything about it. Okay, yeah.
Western medicine might not have a cure, but that doesn't mean that somebody couldn't pursue a macrobiotic diet, which has been found to cure some people, or traditional Chinese medicine, or
holistic type approach to spiritual health, whatever.
Yeah. It just a thought, not really to argue either side. But
right.
Just because Western medicine doesn't have an established cure, doesn't mean there aren't things that someone could do to enhance their life, even if they do have it.
Right. Very good point. And what about the fact that the children may just want that clarity of knowing and not be unknown? What are you're...
For me, this is a simple question. The kids don't get to know. I mean, yeah. So, I was just shaking.
I'm going to guess, and I did not read in advance this week, but I'm just guessing, based on what we've done, that the Jewish law is going to say, if there's more than a 51% that the kids would have this condition hereditary, and if there is something that they can do to improve their situation, they're gonna take the right.
We're not gonna break it down so far. Those are good.
You could also break it down genetically as to, and I don't remember the exact genetics of Huntington's disease, whether it's autosomal dominant, what the chances are that the kids have it.
Right. Some of the kids. Okay. Good. So, in other words.
I think we've all been focusing on the risk that the children may have the disorder.
Right.
But there's also the issue of, like, forget that it's hereditary. Amanda, this whole week is supposed to be our genetics, so it's hereditary, but. Do the children have a right to know what their parent has?
And is going.
What happens if something happens to Mary? Then no one knows what's wrong with their dad.
Right.
Who becomes the guardian, you know, once he's no longer able to make decisions.
So you're saying that there's a risk to the children because then they may be left without a caretaker that can effectively take care of them long term. I hear you.
They're adult children.
They're adult children in this case, 27 to 37.
Right.
Is he saying that they would have to take care of the dad?
They would have to take care of the dad. That's what you're saying. Got it.
Or power of attorney over.
I hear you. Okay. It's a consideration. Yeah.
The underlying basis would be, as opposed to the U.S. system that you discussed, which is all rights-based.
Right.
I like how you're thinking.
Medical profession is all geared toward rights.
Yes.
You know, you have the patient has the right of confidentiality. What I've learned from here in this course is Judaism seems to be more duty-based.
Yes.
So the underlying question would come here, is there a duty, is there a reason to have a duty? And what would be accomplished by performing that duty? So obviously, going back to, you know, Kitty Genovese's case, an American law, hearing a woman screaming, getting raped in an alley, anyone who didn't respond was not legally obligated.
Correct.
Under Jewish law, you would have been legally obligated to respond and attempt to help this person.
Right.
So again, then there would be a good reason to do that, because obviously in helping her, hopefully you'd scare away the attackers.
So the question is, what are the parameters of that obligation? That's exactly what we're going to look at. You're a plant in the audience tonight. I love it. I love it. Boom.
I missed last week.
You're ready to go. This is like BP, knock him out of the park. Okay. let's take a look at the laws of privacy and confidentiality. We need to discuss the difference between the two, because privacy is not the same as confidentiality. Can somebody tell me the difference between them? What is privacy? What is confidentiality?
Confidentiality is that no one else can disclose something.
In other words, privacy is my right, and again, rights in U.S. law, to keep my information to me. No one can come and steal my information from me. Confidentiality is I've shared it with somebody else. So now it's not only my information, but it's my information and this other individual knows the information. He or she is bound not to pass it forward to another party and to more parties, etc., etc. That's the difference between the two. And I'll tell you that we treat the two scenarios completely different. And here's a simple example. Let's use the paparazzi example. Not the song, the paparazzi itself. Paparazzi example is as follows. Can the media in LA trespass on a celebrity's property, take pictures, and publish it in a magazine? The answer is no. If the celebrity is walking in the street, can the photographers snap the pictures and publish them? The answer is yes. What's the difference between the two? I'll ask you another question. Google. Our good friend Google, that's controlling the world and buying Groupon, apparently. Google, yeah, it just came out today, $6 billion. They're looking at it. Anyway, here's the question. They have this street view, as we all know. You click on it, you see. This is a source of big frustration with our good friends in Europe that are not happy with this, for whatever reason. And even some here are not happy with this. But I believe, according to U.S. law, they're very much protected in taking these pictures. But they can do, imagine if Google came out with a new service called Google Home. Check out Rabbi Ari's home, the inside, the interior. Check out, that would be already trespassing, and they could not go there. What's the difference? They can show pictures of the outside of my house. They can't show the pictures inside my house. Because inside my house, I'm protected by the laws of privacy. In fact, when it comes to paparazzi, there is something called constructive. There's a crime to use a telephoto lens, and the crime is constructive invasion of privacy. However, when the individual or when the pictures are being taken outside, we consider it in the public domain. Once you're in the public domain, in other words, you have already relinquished your right to privacy because you stepped outside your house, or because the outside of your house is facing the outside world. So you've already exposed that part of yourself outside. Once it's exposed, once you've relinquished your right to privacy at that point, it's all fair game. This is how the law typically looks at this. The law will therefore apply as well when I share information with somebody else. If I share information with somebody else, typically in most situations, there is no law that prevents the person that I've shared the information with to share it with somebody else. Am I right or wrong? U.S. law does not prosecute somebody for telling a secret. Unless there's a certain context of the relationship. In other words, but let's understand. But then there's another reason. We have to get to the exception, but let's first address the rule. Here's the rule. No one can steal my information. If I'm holding on to information, it's private information. If somebody steals information, they're violating my right, my right to privacy. Once I relinquish my right by sharing the information with somebody else, so in other words, I've taken private information, and I've now made it not so private anymore because I've shared it with a friend, there is no law that prevents that person, that individual, from telling the secret to somebody else. Unless there was a confidentiality clause signed in which the person that I've shared the information signs and says, I will not share it with somebody else. And then there's a separate issue here because they signed the contract. Or if there's an implicit contract or social contract that exists between professionals, certain legal and medical professionals. But that's the exception. We're going to talk about the exception in a second. But again, I want to explain that when it comes to privacy, we take the right of a person maintaining their privacy very seriously. When it comes to confidentiality, there are no laws regarding intrinsic, inherent laws, rights to confidentiality. If you tell your neighbor something, did you hear about that? Whatever. They are not required to protect your secret. They're not required. There's no law that protects your right to that information once you violated that right yourself. You've already violated your own right. Does this make sense? You violated your own right. You've shared it with somebody else. At that point, you don't have the right back. So you can't stop somebody from paying it forward, from divulging it to somebody else. Here, before we get to the exceptions. Actually, no, let's get to the exception. So the big exception is when we're dealing with a professional relationship, like attorney-client, or like medical professional-patient.
Or priest.
Clergy. I have no idea what you're talking about.
I don't think clergy have that.
Clergy only have clergy.
There is an implicit social contract. It doesn't have to even be written, but there is an implicit. U.S. law recognizes and protects individuals, and we're going to understand the reason why. Because we understand why, in general, people don't retain their rights once they've let it go. Because you let it go. What kind of right do you want? You've let it go. Why is it then that when you share personal information with a lawyer, with a doctor, why is it then that the doctor is not allowed to share it with somebody else? You've already shared it. You demonstrate that you don't want the right anymore. The answer is very simple. There's two answers. What do you have?
Well, there's a social benefit to encourage people to be honest with their doctors and their lawyers and their priests.
That's number one. That's the first that we're going to cite that in a second. Number one is, in order for the relationship to be healthy between the client and the attorney, between the patient and the doctor, between the individual and the clergy, whatever it is, in order for that to, and as a society, we want those relationships to work. Because if they don't work, people are going to be sick and people are going to be behind bars for no reason. We want, and legal systems are going to run havoc, and people, we want these relationships to work. In order for it to work, there has to be a safe environment. And the environment has to be one in which I divulge information, personal information. I share my private information with you with the understanding that you're not going to share with anybody else. So even as I'm sharing it with you, I'm not relinquishing my right to maintain privacy of that information. In other words, it's different than when I just speak to somebody. I speak to my neighbor. Boom, it's not private anymore. When I speak to my attorney, when I speak to my doctor, it remains in the private domain. You see the difference? I'm not sharing the information. This is really number two. I'm kind of blending the two reasons together. Okay, let's read them inside. Let's read them aside so we see the distinction. Text 2A and text 2B. Arn, take it away, please. Page 190.
Yeah. Perhaps the most fundamental reason why medical confidentiality is deemed essential to the relationship between healthcare professional and patient is a pragmatic reason that focuses on optimizing this therapeutic relationship. As Margot Granger explained, doctors like priests and lawyers must be able to keep secrets. For medical care to be effective, for patients to be able to trust their doctor, they must be confident that they can talk frankly to him or her. This is evidence that breaches in confidentiality will affect the level of information imparted by patients. Thus, the consequences of breaching confidentiality are likely to result in patients being less candid about the information they divulge to a healthcare professional, which is likely to have further consequence of impeding the level of treatment, support, or counseling they will receive. Confidentiality is fundamental for pragmatic therapeutic.
So it's almost like in this situation, the law grants the rights back to the individual that has shared the information because it's necessary for this relationship to work. Or it's necessary for the healing to work in this case. Okay? A second reason we're going to cite is text 2B. It's a little bit different, and I don't really want to split hairs here. The main point is the main point. But let's just understand that there's two ways to look at it. All right, text 2B. Arn, continue, please.
It is generally accepted that respecting individual autonomy is a fundamental moral principle, enabling individuals to have control over their own lives. Respect for individual autonomy dictates that patients should be in control of their medical treatment, emphasizing the importance of informed consent and confidentiality. Medical Research Council expresses this link with the notion of respect for autonomy by saying, keeping control over facts about oneself can have an important role in a person's sense of security, freedom of action, and self-respect. Just as an instance on informed consent through medical treatment allows patients to make authentic choices about their lives, so medical confidentiality allows patients to remain in control of information about their lives, disclosure of which may be detrimental.
This is a slightly different reason. This says that a person maintains the right to autonomy and to control over their own life within the relationship of doctor-patient. So therefore, it's important that the information be kept confidential so that the patient can retain a sense of autonomy and control over their own life and medical care. Either way you slice it. And you know, to me, what it sounds like, this is just maybe over analysis, but as I was kind of working through it, it sounds to me almost like the way we understand this relationship, if you wanted to kind of graphically depict it, is as follows. In typical relationships, so there's information that I maintain. So let's say the information is inside me. No one is allowed to break into me and take out the information. That's an invasion of privacy. Once I take the information out of myself and put it outside myself, then it's in the open market and then it's fine. Except where there's a medical, let's say, medical professional, legal professional involved, at that point, when I share the information, it's not that I'm taking it outside of myself and sharing with somebody else, but rather I'm allowing that person to step inside me. It's a little bit different. It's not that I'm taking information and putting it out there. Autonomy means I maintain my autonomy. To me means, sounds like, I'm bringing that person into my life, into my experience, so that they can understand what is going on inside, so they can heal me, but not that I'm putting it out there to be out there. It's a radically different concept. Okay. Therefore, the law will maintain, the law will enforce the fact that I maintain my rights even as I tell the medical professional something about my life. Even as I tell the legal professional something about my life. I share the information, it's still mine. Okay. And again, bear in mind that we don't cite this idea when we talk about media and tabloids. You know, you have all of these stories that go around, and the only issue is libel if it's not true. If it's true, if somebody said it, there's no problem if somebody shares it. Why are you sharing personal information? Well, it's out there. Somebody shared it already. It's gone. It's out there. So the New York Times says, these things are printed anyway. You know what I'm talking about. The WikiLeaks.
I still don't understand that. I can't understand how that...
So on how many levels does it not make sense? On so many levels the whole thing doesn't make sense. That the New York Times is saying that it's in the public interest to print this. We're going to get to the legality. We're going to get to understand this according to Jewish law soon, because we haven't presented Jewish law yet. It's in the public, whatever it is. Okay. So be that as it may, the point that we want to make is that in general, there are no rights of an individual to their privacy once they've breached their own privacy. Within certain contexts, professional relationships, the patient does have the right to control their personal medical information. Now, let's contrast this approach with that of Jewish law. So as we know, we've established many times and Aaron mentioned it before, Jewish law does not look at life in terms of rights. That we have the U.S. system for. Jewish law looks at life in terms of obligations, responsibilities, duties, mitzvot, etc. Torah does not talk about rights. The Ten Commandments aren't 10 rights. You have the right to believe in God. You have the right not to bow down to idols. You have the right to honor your parents. These are obligations. Torah speaks in terms of obligations. This is what you have to do. This is what you have. Obligations, duties. Torah is a guide for life. Things that you have to do. When it comes to privacy and confidentiality, there are no rights. I don't have a right to my privacy. How do we understand this in terms of obligations? What are the obligations? Here are the obligations. Every single individual is obligated, every individual without exception, is obligated to not divulge information that pertains to somebody else. In other words, if I hear information... If I know information about somebody else, whether it's true or not true, whether it's good or not good, malicious or not malicious, I am not allowed to share the information. Torah says we are not allowed to share information that regards somebody else. Straight up. This is a prohibition. It's a lav. It's a prohibition in Torah. What's the term in Torah? What's it called? No, that's negative. Rechilut. Rechilut is what we're talking about. And we always hear Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara. Negative words, negative tongue. This is beyond that. Rechilut. Rechilut means gossip. There's a prohibition in Torah. And prohibition, again, is the same as obligation. We're obligated not to. You know, a positive mitzvah is obligated to do something. A prohibition is obligated not to. It's an obligation not to gossip. What does it mean, gossip? To talk about somebody else. It's an obligation. So, does that person, again, let's break this down. You have Mr. A and Mr. B and Mr. C. So, Mr. A is the subject of the gossip. Mr. B is the speaker of the gossip. Mr. C is the one who's getting the information. Okay? Good. According to Torah, does Mr. A have a right to privacy of the information?
Indirectly,
by virtue of the obligation of B, the prohibition of B not to share the information, that indirectly grants A the right to maintain. But that's not how Torah speaks. Torah doesn't
have like you have a right to live because I don't have a right to murder you.
Right? Correct. So right. So it's an indirect. But Torah doesn't say. Nowhere in Torah does it say you have to respect the rights of A to his or her own privacy. Therefore, you're not. No, it doesn't say that. It says that you're not allowed to be a gossiper. Let's read it. Look at this. Text 3a. Text 3a. Liz, will you take it away?
You shall not go around as a Rachel gossip or monder amongst your people. You shall not stand by the shedding of your fellow's blood. I am the Lord, you shall not hate your brother in your heart.
Boom. So really the first sentence is the one that's pertinent. We'll see soon that that's not actually the case. But the first one, the first sentence there, the first verse says, you shall not go around as a rachel, a gossiper, a gossipmonger, amongst your people. In other words, don't spread gossip. It's prohibited. Again, Torah doesn't say Mr. A or Mrs. A has rights to their personal information. It says that B, if you're B, you can't speak about A. Are we talking about good or bad stuff? Are we talking about malicious or innocent? Are we talking about true or untrue, huh?
It's obviously stuff that would harm person B. If you're saying, you go to say, hey, you know what B did? He was so nice, he helped this lady in the grocery. If you're saying nice things about people, that's not good.
No, not true. Even if you say nice things, it's gossip. Yeah?
Because you don't know, I mean, when I learned this stuff, you don't know that many people, their wife, they were at work. And all of a sudden you're saying, oh, I saw him at the grocery store.
That's right.
You think it's a positive thing. You just caught him in a thing, so you can't say anything.
That's right. You were not allowed, huh?
How do you honor someone at a fundraising dinner?
If you have their consent about what you're going to share, then you're allowed to share stuff. But in general, you cannot talk about, or if something is known, if something even Torah understands, accepts the concept of public domain. If information is known out there, and that is typically understood to be known by more, what is it, 3 or 10 people? What's the, there's a certain guideline there as far as what's considered known information. But once it's known, then you can speak about it.
So it's all, what about the news and the newspaper?
We got a real problem. I'm not saying the news is a problem. Everything would have to be broken down on what's actually in the news, what are they actually reporting. But you got a real problem. Half of conversations and tabloids and everything is out of business if you follow Torah, which is probably a good thing. Not for the people that are losing money, but for the health of society. Torah doesn't speak in terms of rights. So understand this. In secular law, confidentiality is limited to professional settings or where there's a confidentiality clause that trumps the assumption that information once shared is not private anymore. In Torah law, it's the opposite. The assumption is that information that's shared cannot be told to anybody. Cannot be passed along. You see the distinction? According to secular law, I have information, private information. I share it with somebody else. They're allowed to bust it open. There's no confidentiality there, unless certain exceptions. In Jewish law, I share information with somebody. They're not allowed to say a word. Torah prohibits somebody from sharing information. So, this is the source in Torah, text 3a. Now, let's take a look at text 3b. Here Maimonides defines what a rachel is, what a gossip monger is. Let's continue.
Who is a Raphael? One who peddles tidbits from one person to another, saying, Mr. A said so-and-so, I heard so-and-so about Mrs. B. Even if it is true, it destroys the world. There is a more serious wrongdoing included in this prohibition. Lashon Hara, speaking disparagingly about others, even if speaking the truth.
Look what Maimonides says. There's Rechilut and Lashon Hara. And what's the difference between them? Rechilut, being a Rachel, a gossip monger, is saying something that's true, but not bad. Because that's Lashon Hara. So again, that's interesting. There's three levels, actually. The last one is missing. Something that's true and innocent, in other words, not negative, is prohibited as Rechilut. Something that's true and negative is prohibited. There's an additional prohibition. In addition to gossiping, you're also reciting Lashon Hara, which is something negative about somebody else. Not only are you gossiping, but it's negative. And if you say something about somebody else that's not only negative but not true, which we would call libel in America, in U.S. law, which is the only thing that's prohibited, here you have three prohibitions in Torah. Rechilut, gossip. Lashon Hara, negative talk. And Motzi Shemra, which means giving out a bad name about somebody. You are slandering. Slander. Three prohibitions. But even the first is prohibited. That's the point. So Maimonides writes that it destroys the world. How do you know this? What does it mean it destroys the world? Gossiping? So again, it's true. It's not negative. It's destroying the world. What does that mean? So here's the deal. I said before that we cited all the verses in 3b. Or they're actually not different verses. Yeah, they are different verses. We cited them all because many understand them to be a progression. You shall not go around as a rachel gossip monger, because by doing so, you cause hate in the heart of your brother, and it will cause shedding of your fellow's blood. You see the juxtaposition. You have three verses that come in a row. You have no gossip. You have the prohibition, you have the idea of not standing by the shedding of your fellow's blood and not hating your brother. The idea is that gossip leads to hate, which could lead to murder. And there's a story in the book of, where is it? In the book of Samuel, should be the book of Shmuel, that talks about this, where Doeg reports to King Saul that he saw a gentleman, a priest, a Kohen, named Ahimelech, give bread and a sword to David. This is David before he was King David, the son-in-law of Saul. And King Saul interpreted this act of Ahimelech as, so what I'm looking for, as an act of sabotage, treason. And he took it out on all the priests of the city called, what was the city called again? The city was called Nov. He killed all the priests of Nov except for one. So murder happened. Why? Because of somebody sharing information about somebody giving somebody else bread and a sword. It's kind of like the grocery, the shopping grocery store example. The idea is that we are prohibited by Torah law to divulge information. Any questions so far? So far, so good. Okay. Let's extend the prohibition even further. The prohibition extends even to situations where the individual does not say, by the way, keep this quiet. In other words, you might think that gossiping is only if somebody says, psst, here's information, keep it quiet. Even if somebody does not say that, the assumption is that the information that you hear has to remain private. Again, Torah says that if you hear information, you cannot divulge it unless you're specifically told to divulge. How do we know this? We know this from the Torah. We know this from the Torah. Text 5a. Greg.
From whence do we know that when a person tells something to a friend, that it should not be repeated until he is told, go and tell? For it says, and God spoke to him from the tent of meeting to say.
God, when God would speak to Moses, the way Torah records it is Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe Lemar. That God spoke to him, in this case it's to him from the tent of meeting, to say. In other words, God is telling Moses specifically to relate the information to others. In other words, were not God to have said, by the way, Moses, you should repeat this information, Moses would not be permitted to repeat the information. You understand? You see how we're the derivation there. If Torah, if God would not have explicitly permitted Moses to share the information, he would not have been allowed to share the information, even though it was not negative information, it was true information, whatever it was. Bottom line is, Torah prohibits information from being passed along. Now, so here we see the dramatic distinction between secular law and Jewish law. In secular law, we assume that the information that you know, that you've heard, can be shared with others, unless there's a confidentiality clause or whatever. In Jewish law, the opposite is true. The assumption is that information may not be shared with others, unless you're explicitly told that you can. See the different distinction? Okay, hope that makes sense. All right, so if I ask you the question, which body of law protects privacy and confidentiality to a greater extent, the answer would be, which system? Secular law? Jewish law, Torah law. Right? Jewish law protects confidentiality to a much greater extent. Even if you were never told to keep it quiet, you got to keep it quiet. Good. Let's talk about the limits of confidentiality in secular law. Because we said before that within the medical professional-patient relationship, the medical professional is charged to keep that information about their patient confidential. So although U.S. law, let's talk about this from a secular perspective. So U.S. law protects the rights of the patient to have their information be kept private and confidential. But there are limitations to this. I'm going to cite four limitations. In other words, i.e. exceptions to the rule, when medical professionals are allowed to break it open. What are these four exceptions? Number one, when the information is already in the public domain. If it's already known, it's already out there, then there's no violation of confidentiality. Number two, when the patient has explicitly waived the rights to confidentiality. If the patient signs a waiver and says, hey, you can pass this along to others, then the doctor certainly is allowed to. Number three, when the doctor is compelled by court order. If there's a court order that demands the medical records or other information for this patient, then the doctor is compelled by law to comply with the court order. Number four is when it's in the public interest that this information be shared. Okay, that's kind of vague, but when it's within the public interest that this information be shared, the doctor is allowed to divulge confidential information. Okay, so I'll give you an example. I guess probably the clearest example, and the one that Greg mentioned before, and the one that I mentioned before as well, is when a doctor, let's talk about a psychiatrist is privy to the homicidal thoughts of his or her patient. So the patient comes in and says, I'm having homicidal thoughts about my ex. So if the psychiatrist has reason to believe that they may act on this desire, the doctor is actually required by law to alert the authorities. Does the doctor go straight to the individual that's at risk? Absolutely not. According to U.S. law, the doctor has to go to the authorities and let the situation be handled from there. Let's take a look at text 7a. Leonard, just in time. Text 7a, page 196.
While confidentiality is held to be central to the relationship between healthcare professional and patient, there would be very few who would argue that this duty to maintain patient confidentiality should be considered absolute. The reasons for this are clear. The very principles that explain the importance of confidentiality also undermine it. Thus, while consequential reasoning and respect for autonomy require that we maintain medical confidences, in some cases the same consequential reasoning and respect for autonomy shall seem to require that we breach confidentiality. Consider the famous Tarasov case, 1976. In this case, a disturbed man revealed to a psychiatrist that he had homicidal thoughts towards his girlfriend. His confidentiality regarding this information was maintained, and the woman was not known. The patient murdered her. On both consequentialist grounds and based on a general respect for autonomy, there are good reasons to argue that confidentiality of a patient with such murderous intentions should be breached in order to warn a third party at risk. While breaching confidentiality in this instance may result in an erosion of trust between patient and psychiatrist, perhaps even result in harm to others as a result, the alternative consequences of failing to prevent murder are severe. Similarly, although a breach of confidentiality undermines the patient's autonomy, removing his control over this information, if respect for autonomy is important in order to allow individuals control over their lives, then not attempting to prevent murder seems inconsistent with this respect for individual lives. Thus, we are left with a scenario where it is typically held that confidentiality should be maintained without exception, but also agree that confidentiality should be broken when people are placed at risk.
So in the Tarasov case, so this guy has murderous intentions. This woman is not, his girlfriend is not warned, and she ends up being murdered by this individual. So we see here the danger of taking confidentiality to its extreme. If you say confidentiality at all costs, you're going to undermine. In other words, if we look at it in the context of rights again, I just want to get back to this way of understanding it. So we said before that the patient has the right to their information being held in confidence by the medical professional. However, if you're really interested in rights, you have to look at the fact that murder will compromise an even more basic right. Yeah, this guy, he has a right to his personal issues, but she has a right to her life. You have to balance those rights, which life trumps which. Sure, autonomy, sure, patient, therapeutic, I have the right to a therapeutic relationship in which I can be open, that's wonderful. You have rights, mazel tov. But she has rights to her life. And there's no way that our system of law will say that when two rights are battling, one for personal expression and autonomy, and one of just life itself, that his right to his information being held in confidence should trump her right to live. So this is how our system of rights deals with conflicting rights. And we have this all the time. My right is to enjoy myself. And that includes maybe playing music in my house. However, and maybe I like loud music. My neighbor has a right to sleep. So when my right to play loud music infringes on my neighbor's right to sleep, the law is going to have to handle the conflicting rights in a certain way. So in this case, patient has a right to their information be held in confidence. She has a right to live. We choose her right to live. And therefore, we tell the doctor, the medical professional, breach the confidentiality to save a life. And how do you breach it? Again, it's not open. You breach it only by contacting authorities and only by divulging the information that's needed that's pertinent in this case. So read, Leonard, please read text 7b, because this continues. This is from the Code of Medical Ethics, from the AMA. This kind of outlines which information ought to be shared in a case where a doctor is told, breach confidentiality.
The physician should not reveal confidential information without the express consent of the patient, subject to certain exceptions that are ethically justified because of overriding considerations.
Which is what we're talking about. In other words, in case, so, and still there are conditions. Go.
When a patient threatens to inflict serious physical harm to another person or to him or herself, and there is a reasonable probability that the patient may carry out the threat, the physician should take reasonable precautions for protection of the intended victim, which may include notification of law enforcement authorities.
Notice that it doesn't say to notify the individual that has been threatened. It's notify the law. Continue.
When the disclosure of confidential information is required by law or court order, physicians generally should notify the patient.
What does that mean, notify the patient? FYI, your confidentiality is about to be breached because I'm obligated by law to do so.
Physicians should disclose the minimal information required by law, advocate for the protection of confidential information, and, if appropriate, seek a change in the law.
What does that mean? Seek to not divulge it. Why? Because even though you have to, in certain cases, give up the information, you seek to minimize the damage, and you also seek, perhaps, to fight it. Now, this doesn't necessarily refer to only cases where somebody's life is at risk. This could be in many legal cases where the law requires medical professionals, hospitals, doctors to divulge information. The point is that if you are the one with whom that information was trusted, as a doctor, medical professional, or even an attorney, lawyer, you should try to resist it as much as possible. Okay. This is what the AMA writes. Good. So let's look at the discussion question right there. Based on text 7A and 7B, can you provide examples of situations that might justify a breach of confidentiality? Examples? Within professional relationships where breaches might be justified. Wait. That's a complicated case.
It's complicated.
Why?
Well, you could do it if she's going to die. Now you're going to do it so that she doesn't have other worries. You're doing it for her health.
So first, not everyone necessarily knows the video case. So first describe the video case, and then explain what you got.
The video case involves a guy who needs a kidney transplant, and a young girl, and she turns 18. His daughter. Goes and tries to donate the kidney and finds out that your daddy ain't your daddy, but your daddy, but your mommy doesn't know it.
Who the baby daddy?
Who the baby daddy, right. So he knows, the father knows, the lad knows, the doctors know. Do they need to tell the girl about it?
So I'll ask you, does this fit into the parameters? Is she at risk?
Yeah.
What's the risk?
Well, the risk is she's going to spend the rest of her life worrying about contracting this disease. She's going to go turn around and give this kidney under totally false pretenses.
They have an option of just telling her that she's not a match. The question is, does she have to divulge the information that are the doctors, should the doctors tell her, by the way, that's not your father?
We're assuming that the information is going to help her in her medical care.
No, she's not in risk. She's not a risker. He's a risk. He's a transplant.
She's at risk for getting this polycystic kidney disease because it's hereditary. And that's the medical advantage to her. Well, flip it the other way then, and just change the facts a little bit, that she, you know, that now she knows she is going to get the disease. I mean, flip it the other way, that she finds out that this guy, who she didn't think was her father, is her father, and now she's got a chance to get a hereditary disease. What I'm saying is you can divulge the information to this party for her health concern.
That's so simple.
And every parent's medical files will be open to their kids, because any cancer risks or any high blood pressure risk and cholesterol risk, I mean, now you're just saying, hey, all this information is relevant to your children, so parents have no confidentiality.
We have to open up everything, right. which the law clearly does not provide for.
Right, and unless there's an imminent threat, I mean, I don't agree with that.
Right, so that's typically how it's been understood in U.S. law, that if there's an imminent threat, like but there's a gray area here, because it's got to be the call of the physician or the doctor, the medical professional. It's got to be the call of that person that has the information to say, I believe this is a clear and present danger. I believe that it's an imminent danger, and I think that action has to be taken right now to alert whoever needs to be alerted. But in a case where there doesn't seem to be something so immediate, there's somewhat of more of a gray area. Other cases, as I said before, would be spousal abuse or child abuse, where the physician sees signs of that abuse. We have to alert the authorities. I asked before the question about HIV. The husband comes in, and it's determined that he's HIV positive. You tell the wife, what do you do? I did some research. I didn't do comprehensive research. I did a little research. I found that some states, it's interesting, the wording. I was looking up New York, just because, you know, why not? New York State says like this. I have like a handbook. So what if I'm HIV positive? What's the next step? So it says that the doctors, whatever, the medical staff will counsel you as far as how to share this with your partners or whatever it is. And support group and support will be available, and all the information you need will be available, et cetera, et cetera. But it doesn't go as far as mandating that individual turn in the names of their spouse or their other significant others or partners, or needle sharers, for that matter. And the law giving them a phone call, or and the fact that it's mandated that the doctors that are privy to the information contact everyone who they're involved with this information. Maybe it's because we don't deem HIV positive to be an imminent threat to life. Could be. I don't know. But I just know that in the way the U.S. law is right now, at least in certain states, the law is that doctors are not required to contact significant others. They can contact the spouse if I think they're allowed to. They don't have to.
The problem is HIV is kind of a special disease. It's like, you know, breast cancer is more important than other types of cancer because, you know, it's the law in Georgia, as I understand it, is okay, when you go in the hospital, it used to be that they would have to beg you to get a little blood to test if there was a needle stick accident.
Yeah.
And now you go in the hospital because you're not required to give them blood, you're not required to divulge, you're not required to tell the doctor that you're HIV positive. Now they make you want to get in, the first thing you do, you gotta give a little vial of blood. And, which they reserve the right to test for HIV.
But can they share the information with others? If they find that you're positive?
To get in the hospital, you need to divulge.
But that's for them. I'm asking, can they go ahead and say, can they call the missus? They can't do that.
But HIV is a special disease in that respect, because if you have tuberculosis, you've seen on the airplanes what they did to these people. If somebody flew over and he had that respiratory thing, or he had tuberculosis on an airplane or something.
A few years ago.
Yeah.
The guy from Atlanta.
Yeah, and they put all these people in quarantine, and they tested all these people, and they made them tell all this stuff. I mean, that's not a special... HIV is good. It's they're protecting the rights of these people as a special thing.
I don't know.
They don't have clear laws.
It's also, I believe it's a felony in Georgia, if you're... And I don't know if this is specific to HIV or all sexually transmitted diseases. It's at least a felony if you are aware that you're HIV positive to knowingly give it to someone.
To knowingly engage in intimacy, or to knowingly, yes, to that?
To have sex.
HIV only.
Knowing that you're HIV positive.
You have to tell your...
But that's just so it's interesting then. Here we find that
it's not sharing, right? That's the character case. The crime is not sharing with the potential partner that you're HIV positive, right?
Correct.
Right.
Now, hold on. But
that other person can make their choice or take protection.
It's not whether you give it to them or not. It's just
whether you're actually engaging in sex. You know, what's interesting with that is that seems to be an obligation. Or is it a protection of the other's rights? I guess it's probably a protection of their rights.
I think at least when this case happened, it was an obligation. There was an Emory medical student who went to jail for doing that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting. I will say, though, that according to what I understand, it's limited to the individual sharing the information with their partner or potential partner, as opposed to the ability of the doctors to violate the confidence within which they hold this information to go ahead and call up the missus and say, or whoever it is, and say, hey, I got some information that you might want to know.
I wonder if it changes since being HIV positive, I believe, is no longer considered a fatal disease.
Correct. That's what I said before. Maybe it's not considered a clear and present danger on a definitive. So on the one hand, we do take protection. We have a felony if somebody is not being upfront about it. The other hand, I don't think that the... Yeah, what do you have?
I was just going to say, it'd be totally ineffective to give a doctor that responsibility, because even if you call the wife, you don't know who else this person is sleeping with. You don't know in the past or in the future.
But what if you know that the wife is involved? Why would that not protect the wife? I understand that you're saying you can't do everything, but why, if you know the wife, why can't you call the wife? Or why don't you have to call the wife? I'm saying you don't have to. He has to tell the wife.
I don't even think you're allowed to.
So I know in New York you're allowed to. I saw in New York the doctors are allowed to.
Are allowed to.
If he gives the name of the wife. He doesn't have to give the doctors the name of the wife.
You would
read it better than I can. But it was straddling that line. I couldn't exactly figure it out. But certainly they're not required to. But again, in certain cases where they feel that there's a present danger to somebody's life, they have to share the information with the authorities. They have to. They're obligated. So again, why HIV? Maybe it's not so, you know, clear and imminent as far as
it's
that.
It's a danger. I mean, even if
it's danger.
Document, it's, those drugs are pretty nasty. It's a couple $100,000.
It's not. So let's get back. Let's get back to genetics. Even though it's all genetics, but let's get back specifically to genetics. Genetics. Okay. So when we deal with genetics, the question is the physician or doctor, medical professional, is the physician required or even allowed to breach confidentiality and pass along the information to the family members? Okay, so let's take a look at text number 8. This is a very critical text. Lynn, 199 text 8.
Genetic knowledge has implications for individuals themselves as well as other family members. In general, health professionals encourage people to pass on genetic risk information to their relatives.
In other words, we encourage the individuals to pass along to their relatives. Continue.
However, the disclosure of such information is not always straightforward, and consequently, some people may not be aware of their risk. If risk information is actively withheld, genetic counselors may need to determine whether they have a duty to pass this on, particularly when preventive action can be taken.
So it's interesting because according to text 8, we have two criteria for a doctor passing along genetic information. So number one is we encourage the individual, tell your family. The second, but if that's not happening or if that's being muddled or the information is not being passed along in a straightforward and clear way, so then the doctor is going to have to determine whether or not there is a duty to pass this along, again, particularly when preventative action can be taken. In other words, there has to be a threat. Criteria number one is there has to be a threat to the other party. And criteria number two is there has to be a situation where that party can take preventative action. In other words, the information has to be, this is what I said, has to the information would have to be information that has utility. Something you can do with the information.
This is the
right.
U.S.
So
this is the U.S.
preventive action. Is it just medical preventive action?
So that was the question I was reading before, right? Tina asked the question before.
History of, you know, cancer, however, eating a low-fat diet may help prevent that from occurring to the children.
Right.
Or
right. So
is preventive action planning financially for a parent who's going to be disabled?
I don't know that the U.S. law is going to take into consideration finances. I believe that it's when for a doctor to breach confidentiality, it has to be a situation of, from what I understand, life and death.
Or is preventative action, as you were suggesting, would that be like your own childbearing planning? If with this 27-year-old child is preventative action that they plan because of the information to
that,
not pass it.
That might be a relevant consideration. As we're going to say, according to Jewish law, definitely yes. I don't want to tip the hand too far. But Jewish law is going to go in that direction. In U.S. law, there's somewhat of a gray area. We don't have clear guidelines. I'll tell you a case. Here's the case that happened. There's a legal precedent. Happened in New Jersey in 1996. Safer versus a state of PAC. So what happened was there was an individual, a physician who treated a man for colon cancer. The man passed away. 26 years after the man passed away, his daughter learned that she had colon cancer and other complications, and she sued the physician's estate. He had since passed on. It was 26 years later, the physician had died. She sued the estate of the physician for his failure to notify her that her father had died of colon cancer so that she could take preventative action. This was the lawsuit. So the court, the lower court, the trial court, dismissed the case, saying that there was no relationship between the physician and the daughter. There was no relationship between the physician and the patient. It was on appeal. The appellate court ruled that there is a duty, I'm quoting here, there is a duty to warn reasonably foreseeable third parties at risk, and that reasonable steps be taken to assure that the information reaches those likely to be affected or is made available for their benefit. Yeah, or made available for their benefit, even if those steps require a breach of confidentiality. So the court ruled that she had a valid lawsuit against the estate of the physician because he has an obligation to share the information with the daughter, with the family. Why? Because there were reasonable steps that could have been taken.
And it's so much more far out than the case on the video.
Why? It's the same case we're talking about. It's the same genetic case we're talking about the whole time. Same thing.
No, but here, if the doctor didn't know this daughter, he had no relationship with her. Here, the doctor does have a relationship with the daughter because the daughter came into his clinic to for.
Yeah, but the case that we've been talking about before is that the doctor doesn't have a relationship with the kids. That's but this is the issue we're addressing. The doctor knows that the patient has a certain illness, disease, whatever it is. The doctor knows something about the patient. This information can affect a relative.
We got to go get his family tree. I mean, that's the thing. This other daughter was in his clinic. The one on the video.
I understand. Right now, I understand what you're saying. I understand the distinction. You're right. It's a step further. So the court, the precedent, at least in New Jersey, the court ruled that the physician did have an obligation to pass along the information to the daughter because it was a foreseeable risk.
Huh? And all the cousins. And brothers
steps.
And sisters.
Huh?
What preventable steps? Maybe there
was a colonoscopy, that's all.
Yeah, that could have been. Okay.
Was it just that the father had colon cancer, or was it that they had a polycystic syndrome that was more?
So she learned that she had colon cancer and multiple metastatic polyposis. I don't know what that is. Polyposis. Am I saying that right?
Everybody has that.
I don't know what it is. Yeah.
Not only are you giving them. Breach of confidentiality has such wide-reaching things that the doctor's required to go tell your kids all the stuff you got.
Well, it gets back to what he said earlier about, like, well, is the doctor obligated to tell every patient's children that their parent has high blood pressure and,
that's right, that's the
you
same.
Know, high cholesterol and everything else?
Yeah.
Like, where do you draw the line? So the
wording is reasonable steps be taken to assure that the information reaches those likely to be affected or is made available for their benefit. So it seems like the court is ruling in this case that there. See, it's not an imminent danger. It happens 26 years later. But it seems to be a clear and present enough of a danger that the court is required to be divulged. But the bottom line is, it is a gray area. It is a gray area. And there's no, especially going back to the case that we had to begin the class with, our case study, which is talking about Huntington's disease, which doesn't have a cure, and right now, at least with traditional medicine, doesn't have. There's no preventative action, quote unquote preventative action that we know of that can be taken. Or let's say there is a case where we know there's no cure, and we don't know of any preventative action that can be taken. So the question is, in that case, are there any grounds for the physician to go ahead and divulge information? Huh?
Sure. I mean, the guy will live his life too.
Oh, he knows about it. You're talking about the kid. No, he knows about it. No, the doctor has to share it with the patient. The question is,
and the kid will live his life,
maybe. But there are no clear guidelines for this in U.S. law. Let's talk about Jewish law for a second, because Jewish law brings something else to the table. So when we talk about the limits of confidentiality in Jewish law, we spoke before about the obligation to keep information confidential, not only if you're in a professional relationship, but even if you're in a casual relationship. You know, you hear information, you can't. You can't spread the information, but here too, huh?
You can't be a religious paparazzi.
Yeah, no, that would be problematic. Not that I would speak against the paparazzi; they're Jewish, but it could pose a pretty serious halachic issue. Now, here's the question: are there limitations? Are there scenarios where the doctor is allowed to violate, or anybody? Forget doctors. Are there situations where you can break open the information and share it with others? The answer is yes. Number one, the first exception, as we know, is to save a life. Now, why is that? Again, we're not dealing with a system of rights. We're dealing with a system of obligations. Now, we know within a system of obligations / mitzvot, when you're dealing with two mitzvot that you're handling at the same time, so you gotta balance the mitzvot. So I have one mitzvah. One mitzvah tells me, don't pass along the information. The other mitzvah tells me, save a life. So I got to balance the mitzvahs. Which one trumps which? Right? Confidentiality or saving a life? So we know saving a life trumps all other mitzvot. That's how the balance works out. So if I know information that is potentially life-saving, I am required by Jewish law to share that information with whoever needs the information. With the authorities? Not necessarily. Here's the difference. Here's the distinction. I need to protect somebody whose life is in danger. I have information that puts at risk that individual. I have information that somebody is planning on harming that individual. I'm obligated by Jewish law to take whatever steps are necessary to prevent that harm to that person's life. Whether it means telling them directly or getting law enforcement involved, but even telling that person directly, I'm obligated. It's not, there's no rights here. I have an obligation to protect that person's life. So, and one example of this, by the way, is a biblical example of Rebecca, matriarch Rebecca, who finds out that Esau, her son, is planning on killing her other son, Jacob. And therefore she tells Jacob, you gotta hightail it out of town because your brother wants to kill you. The question is, oh, she's so gossiping. She's divulging personal information. How is she allowed to do that? Well, the answer is because she's saving a life. Jacob's life is at risk. Esau, she overhears Esau plotting to kill him. So she says to Yaakov, get out of Dodge. And she's allowed to do that to save a life. Okay. But the mitzvah in Jewish law extends also to non-life-threatening situations, but rather areas of personal harm. Let's take a, this becomes a critical text. Ben, take a look at text 9a. Please read this. Text 9a.
If one hears of evildoers plotting to cause harm or intending to set a trap for his friend and does not inform him, he violates the prohibition of you shall not stand by the shedding of your fellow's blood.
In other words, even though typically you do not share information that you've heard, if you hear evildoers plotting to cause harm, etc., you do share the information. Not only are you allowed to share the information, you have to share the information. What about your obligation to not share information? It's trumped by an obligation to not stand idly by your brother's blood.
But that's the quote is referring to murdering. And you're stretching it to. I've been trying through the whole class. I mean, being an ophthalmologist, we don't kill too many people. If the thing would make some bad, you know, she's got
on a good day.
Disease that could be blinded.
We're gonna get to another question soon. What if you're privy? You, in your practice, are privy to information that somebody should not be on the road, driving. Mm-hmm. What's your obligation?
You're not obligated to stay to work and tell
anybody. Let's talk about this in Jewish law now. We got to discuss this. Of course, yeah, but I understand that this relates to you. But let's understand, this relates to you. What your patient's lack of seeing ability is now known to you, and you're holding that information in confidence. But it could harm other people, other drivers, innocent potential victims. Are you what do you do about it? You encourage him to not renew the license. But what if he says, I'm still going to drive? What do you do? So Georgia says, you can't take... So let's talk about this. This is a very important question. We're going to get there soon. So, but your question directly was, how do we move this from bloodshed, preventing bloodshed, to preventing other things? So notice the words of Maimonides. Is if one hears an evildoer plotting to cause harm or intending to set a trap. That doesn't only refer to murder. Text 9b. It's Eliezer Waldenberg. He explains this. Continue, Ben.
We deduce from these words of Maimonides that the prohibition of you shall not stand by the shedding of your fellow blood does not only refer to an act of murder, but includes anyone who stands by and does not act to save a peer from any harm that is being planned for him or any trap being set for him.
In other words, the way Maimonides understands the verse is that it can be open. Now, how does Maimonides know this? And by the way, there are other prohibitions that also might come in, like the prohibition of returning. We're going to see this in text 9c. There's a mitzvah to return someone's lost property, which means if you see somebody about to lose their property, you have to take preventative action to save their property. So if you see somebody that's trying to harm somebody in business, 9c is going to spell this out beautifully. But bottom line is, you would be required by Jewish law to violate your other mitzvah of keeping things on the hush-hush and protect somebody else. In other words, here's the bottom line. In general, you're obligated to keep things in confidence. Unless someone's being put at risk, someone's being harmed. Not only their life, but their finances and their well-being. One more text. You're doing the 9. It's 9C.
All the books of ethics make a tumult about the prohibition of gossip.
Now, obviously he's referring to Jewish books of Jewish ethics. Continue.
I make a tumult about a greater wrong that is more prevalent. That of withholding information when it is necessary to communicate it in order to save a victim from one who wishes to oppress him. For example, if one sees someone ambushing another on the road in the forest in order to kill him, or one sees someone digging a tunnel at night into the house or store of another, it is possible that because of the prohibition of tail-bearing, he should not warn the victim to be cautious.
No, is it possible that, yeah. I can't gossip, so I can't tell you that someone is planning on killing you, or someone's planning on burrowing into your home and ripping you off. I can't share information. I wouldn't want to gossip. Continue.
Doing this is a great sin, as it violates the commandment, "You shall not stand by shedding of your fellow's blood." And regarding monetary issues, there is a mitzvah of returning lost objects.
So here he cites the second issue of the mitzvah of returning lost objects with regards to monetary. Continue.
Now, what difference is there between seeing the digger of a tunnel, or seeing a friend's servant stealing his fortune, or seeing his partners take advantage of him in business, or seeing scoundrels cheat him, or seeing someone known not to repay a debt attempt to borrow money from him, or seeing an evil person being proposed to him in marriage? All of these cases are included in the mitzvah of returning lost objects and saving another from danger. Wow.
Yeah, look at that. That's a powerful text. That becomes the critical text today. Right there. Yeah, there's a mitzvah to not gossip and not spread information. However, there's a mitzvah to protect someone's life and financial stability and well-being otherwise. Which means that there you have an obligation, and it's an overriding obligation. Again, you have to weigh obligations, but this is overriding. When you know, when you're privy to information that somebody is planning on harming somebody else or will harm someone else, you have to share with the victim that information. You have to. Whether it's you know somebody's planning on burrowing into their home or office to steal, whether it's the servant stealing, whether it's partners taking advantage of him in business, scoundrels treating him, somebody that's not going to repay the debt that you know is not going to repay the debt, but is approaching this person for a loan and you know it's not going to end pretty, or you see an evil person being proposed to him in marriage. In all these cases, if you have the information, you cannot keep it in confidence. You have to share it with somebody else to prevent an innocent person from harm. So the Chafetz Chaim, he elaborates on this idea, and he extends it to cases where the individual, focusing on the story of marriage, where the prospective spouse, with prospective husband or wife, is withholding information, medical information, that might otherwise sway the decision of the other party. Does this make any sense? I don't know if I said that clearly. In other words, if one of the parties knows that they have a medical condition that the other party doesn't know because it's an internal medical condition. Chafetz Chaim lived from 1839 to 1933. So obviously genetic stuff wasn't, at least on such a level that we have today, wasn't going on then. But his point is that if there's something internal that the match cannot see, and there's a third party that knows about it, they're obligated to blow the whistle and say, "Hey, before you get engaged and before you marry this person, FYI, I know something. You may want to know this information."
Just to clarify, it's not an obligation to tell on the cheat or turn the cheat in. It's an obligation to protect the victim.
Correct.
From engaging with the cheat.
Why? Because the Torah says, "Don't stand idly by your brother's blood, or return the lost property of your fellow." It doesn't talk about going. Now, if the way to do that is by contacting authorities, then that's what you do. But the obligation lies between the one holding the information and the victim that is going to be harmed by that information being withheld.
Extremely problematic, and I wonder if Ben isn't thinking of the same situation I am. One, you could think about that in many business situations. However, you don't have complete information. One person who's doing business with another may have some flaws and may have an intention of extorting some money and not providing the exact service that they're saying,
right,
knowing that the service is not all that they're saying that it
right.
is. However, it may in fact be what this person needs, and this person is getting something else from that relationship or interpersonally.
100%.
Maritally, we had a friend, and we thought that their intended was not good for them. And we thought it pretty strongly. And we really weighed, do we have a serious discussion?
Yeah.
Well, you know what? 15 years later, that person turned out to be a really good partner for that that person. You just have incomplete
right. information. So this idea, these laws, when we try to extend it in other areas, the conditions are that there are a few conditions. Number one is that you know the information, the alleged information, 100%. So how do you know? So first of all, it has to be firsthand knowledge. Can't be, you know, hearsay knowledge. It has to be firsthand knowledge. So you have to have direct knowledge of the situation. You have to be confident. You have to be sure that the person that is the alleged potential victim doesn't know about it. If there's any doubt that maybe they do know about it and they don't care, then you cannot approach. Then you don't get involved. So there's a lot of things involved, and you have to be certain that by you saying something, it's actually going to make a difference. So then you say something. Otherwise, I would save a life. You probably do anything because you know you just got to take that chance. But when it comes to the other areas of protection, it's even as we blow it open, it's somewhat limited. The circumstance, and you're right. We never know. How do you ever know? How do you ever know that the, you know, the idea of an evil person being proposed to a marriage? You're right. It's gray. What does it mean, evil person? I didn't define an evil person. You know, but
well, and the kind of. Another theme of the class has been, okay, so here are some guidelines, here are some rules. Every situation is different.
Correct.
Go seek counsel of a rabbi.
Correct.
So now are you gossiping or lashon hara when you go to your rabbi and say, look, this is the problem. I've heard so-and-so. I need help.
That's still in confidence. I think that's the rabbi moving into your space, not hearing it outside. But I think that's pertinent here as well. And it was every case would have to be judged on its own merit. And ultimately, I think it sounds like you made the right decision when you were weighing it.
Thank God we made the right decision.
But I think
it's been horrendous.
Well, you would have told this person what you thought, and then he would have weighed the facts and done what he wanted to.
Oh, look, I know stories and very close to me where a person was asked about somebody, and the person that was asked said a very negative report, said, oh, he's a... You don't want to marry him. She married him. They're happy. And it's okay, because you didn't like him. But it's okay. Turns out he's perfect for me.
The obligation isn't to prevent the person or break it
the
up.
Person is, the thing is, if you believe that one party is purposefully withholding information from the other to do a once-over on them, and you know the information that you believe is purposely being withheld from that person, and you're sure that they don't know it, you're sure that this is information that you know, then you're obligated to tell. Now, you're obligated to break it up, and you don't know, ultimately they can make their own decision.
We're also not talking about opinion. It's not saying you're obligated to share your opinion.
No, not at all.
It's about an obligation to share facts that are within
right. So getting to 9D, which is very important, what the Chafetz Chaim says, if you know that a person has an internal illness, the observer, I'll read it quickly. If one sees that someone wants to marry a particular individual and the observer knows that the groom has major flaws and that the other party is not aware of this and that they would not want to go ahead with the marriage if they were aware of this fact. Now, how do you know that? Again, that becomes a gray area. Then this information should be disclosed by the observer. This refers to a flaw due to illness, which the other party is not aware of because it is internal and not apparent to all. So if you know a certain illness that the person has and they're not presenting it to the prospective marriage partner, And you believe that they're going to become a victim in this situation, you share the information. You're obligated by Torah law. Again, you have to be careful. You can't just wield this indiscriminately. But this is an obligation that theoretically exists. What do you have?
To the effect that you can't be an anonymous tipster, otherwise the information may not be taken seriously.
No, not necessarily saying anonymous. By the way, according to Jewish law, even as you do this, your first step of action must be to encourage the individual directly involved to share the information. You say, listen, fella, she needs to know. It's not right what you're doing. You give them the opportunity, you encourage them, you persuade them. If all else fails, and they tell you, I do not want to share the information, I don't care what you say. In other words, you feel that energy of, I hear you. In other words, you confront the person. You say, you encourage. And if they say, no, I don't want to, and I don't care what's going to... Then you have no choice but to go for it and to share it on your own. But you're right, you would do so in a direct fashion so that it's going to have any effect. You don't. If it's not going to have an effect, then what's the point of doing it in the first place?
It says it refers to an illness, but obviously it's much greater than that, right?
Of course. Yeah, it could be, but it has to be something.
He's a debt, and he hasn't told the prospective spouse that he's a debt.
If it's a serious enough thing that we believe that if she knew about it, that's a great example. I love that example. If you know your buddy, he's $100,000 in debt. And you know this girl, or you think you know this girl, and she would. This is relevant information for her to know. You go to the guy and you say, "Did you tell her? Because she doesn't seem like the person that. Did you tell her?" And if he says, "No, I don't tell her. I don't plan. I didn't tell her. I don't plan on telling her." Then you ask a Rav, and then if theoretically there might be a situation where halacha will tell you, you have to go and tell her. Whereas in secular law, that does not apply. That will never apply in secular law. Are you allowed to? Of course you're allowed to. There's no prohibition in the first place in secular law to gossip about someone's debt. Understand where it's coming from. In Jewish law, there is a prohibition, and yet it's over. You see where we're going with this? It's a totally different picture. There's an there's a prohibition against gossiping about someone's debt, unless there's an obligation to protect somebody else. Let's get back to the Janetta case study. Our friend, who was our friend? What was his name? What was his name? Jay?
Mary.
Jim. Jim and Mary. So what do we do with Jim? Jim has Huntington's disease, and there's officially right now, there's no cure, there's no preventative action. So what do you do? So according to Jewish law, you might say, you don't share the information. Why? Because you only share the information if there's a victim, if somebody's at risk, right? If somebody's at risk either physically or otherwise, financially. But what risk are their children at? If they have it, they have it. I mean, there's what preventative. You would share the information. You're obligated to share the information with the victim if the victim could take action to prevent themselves from something. What action could they take? So here's a reason in Jewish law why you would have to tell the children. If the children are unmarried, and their spouses need to know. Here's the wrinkle. You like this wrinkle? If any of their children are unmarried, it becomes relevant information to share because their spouse needs to know the information.
Even if they're married.
Even if they're married, but it's too late. Oh, and if they don't, right? So
they have kids, they're going to have more.
There are more kids, right? So that's the other thing, right? So, but I want to use the marriage thing because that's a twist that we didn't see coming. The twist is, huh?
If they're already married, they have children, their kids would
be. But the twist...
There's a lack of effective treatment, so what difference does it make? Who has to know? Who doesn't know?
Because then you might not have kids, right, or with that particular person.
Correct. Right. But let's get back to my twist here, about the marriage partner. Again, if any of the kids are not married, the doctor knows the information. Again, forget secular law. Jewish law. You know information. You have information. And your information that you know can adversely affect somebody else. You need to prevent that person from being adversely affected. So if the children are single and maybe of marriageable age, whatever, you have to figure out how this is all going to play out practically. There theoretically may be an obligation to share with the children in the context of allowing the spouse to make an informed decision whether or not they want to make that informed decision. And there would be an informed a necessity to inform with regards to having children, etc. So, I mean, there's other reasons why you would have to inform. But again, in Jewish law, there would be good reasons to have to inform. Yeah.
The problem really is that every single one of these things has consequences both ways. And take the driver's license thing.
Oh, wait, we haven't got there yet. I'm going to get there in a second.
If I have to call up every time and tell the driver's license to take away this guy's license, none of these old people ever come in to get new glasses when they couldn't see. They'd be afraid that...
Oh, we're going to talk about this. Give me a second. I'm going to get to your situation. I thought you were going to go another direction. You're going to be out of business. Your reputation is going to be shot. You're the whistleblower. No, there's two things that you said. I want to split hairs. There's two things. First of all, you're going to destroy socially. You're going to destroy medically, whatever. You're going to destroy people from getting the proper medical care, number one. Number two, you're going to destroy your own business. That becomes a critical consideration, Jewish law. I'm going to go through it, part three. We're going to get there in a second. Oh, we really got to get there. Yeah. What do you have?
I was just going to say, as we advance through genetic testing, we're going to learn more and more about ourselves.
Yeah.
And what we possibly can get in the future. So Jewish law would say all that stuff is relevant to our future spouse?
No. No. Only if it's relevant.
Yeah, I mean...
Only if it's relevant.
If we're genetically inclined to die at age 45, maybe they're going to say, well, I don't want to marry someone who's going to die at 45.
again, so what we're doing tonight is we're not by any means, no, by any, we're not by any means, when to use the halakhic term, we're not passing in, we're not ruling on anything. I just want to present the issues that would be looked at in Jewish law, which I think has a clarity of thought that we don't find in secular law. Has a beautiful clarity of thought here to think, wait a second, I have an obligation to keep my mouth shut in every case, but I have an obligation to protect the victim, an unwitting victim. What's going on here? Is there going to be a victim? Is there not a victim? Is the fact that the spouse is going to die at 60 and not 70, is that considered a victim? Again, well, I'm not deciding on this, or 45 versus whatever. I'm just saying, this is the way it's going to be looked at. All right, let's look at the final consideration, and with this we wrap up the course. What about a case where Jewish law would theoretically mandate a physician to blow the whistle? But the physician knows that if he blows the whistle in this case, and maybe another case similar to it, he's going to lose money. Business will be destroyed, or maybe he'll get fired. What do you do? Do you follow halacha, Jewish law, when it might harm you financially, reputationally, if that's a word, which is not, or otherwise? What do you do? What do you do when basically Jewish law is in conflict with your personal best interests? Or you may get thrown in jail. Right? What do you do? But Jewish law mandates me to breach confidentiality, but secular law doesn't. What do you do?
With respect to secular law, the law of the land is Torah law. Right?
Not if it goes against Torah law. If it doesn't go against Torah law, fine. If the secular law says whatever, you don't have to follow that. But what if, but you're dealing with a situation now. You're going to get thrown in jail, or you're going to get fired, or you're going to lose a lot of money. You're going to go out of business. If you blow, so here's the classic case: the eye doctor knows that the driver should not be on the road. Do you report? Are you allowed to report? Do you have to report? If you report, well, may sound like the right thing to do, but it may harm you. So here's the deal: here's how we break it down. It depends. And even when I say it depends, it further depends. But we can't really get into everything. But here's the general distinction. If I'm blowing the whistle to save a life, if Torah law is mandating me to divulge information, because that information is going to harm, because without divulging that information, lives will be lost. In other words, if somebody has horrible eyesight, they can't see, and them being on the road is deadly, at that point, there is a stronger argument to say that even if it's going to harm me, again, I don't know, legally in jail, I don't know if I'm going to go that far, but even if it's going to harm me financially, I have an obligation to save lives. There's a stronger argument. If, however, the eyesight is not so bad that it's a deadly situation, it's just they're not legally able to drive. In other words, if there's a legal standard, cutoff, you know, up here's good, here's no good, and they're right here, they're no good, but it's not like they're going to kill anybody imminently on the road, at that point, it becomes different. Why? Because I'm not obligated to tell the authorities and have this guy's license revoked from a position of saving lives, but rather promoting society, following the rules, giving back to society, doing the right thing, creating a safer society. Again, it's not life or death, it's a safer society. So it's really me doing the right thing. However, me doing the right thing for somebody else while causing myself harm, I'm not obligated to do in Torah law. Torah law says like this. I'll give you an example with regard to returning lost property. If there's a hurricane, tsunami, whatever it is. Tsunami's a little extreme. If there's a flood and stuff is being washed down the river, and I only have one hand available, and I see two parcels, two items, one of mine and one of my neighbor's. Torah law says you've got to return your neighbor's stuff. So do I say, well, I have that mitzvah, I gotta take my neighbor's stuff, let my stuff go down the river? You could say that if you wanted to. You're not obligated to. You're not obligated in Torah to return someone else's property at the expense of your own financial loss. Which means that if it's a situation where me blowing the whistle on somebody is doing a kindness for others At my own expense, I'm not obligated to do so. I'm not obligated to put myself at a loss, or to harm my business, to lose my customers, to destroy my reputation, by breaching the confidentiality of this patient in order just to help society in a theoretical or general sense. However, as I said before, if it's a situation where there seems to be an imminent threat of danger, of life and death, then even if it's going to be at my own peril, there's a stronger argument to say, again, I'm not saying anything definitively, there's a stronger argument to say that I would have to take those steps to divulge the information. Does this make sense?
If everybody did that would be bad.
Oh, and that's the final point, which I didn't really want to get into, but it's, if, since you mentioned it, we can get into it, which is the idea of ransom. This becomes a very... You see where I'm going with this. There's a halacha that says that the mitzvah of ransoming captives is the greatest mitzvah of all. You do whatever it takes to raise the money to redeem captives. That's one mitzvah. At the same time, it says in halacha that if the captors are asking... if the captors are asking an inflated sum, captors are asking for an inflated, then you're not allowed to pay it. Why? You're encouraging them to continue. So if what you're doing is destroying the fabric of society, in other words, you might say sacrifice, it's hard to say this, sacrifice the individual to protect the clown. When the pirates, not my Pittsburgh Pirates because they're irrelevant on any level, but when the pirates ask for millions of dollars, there might be a sense where a government would say, there's no way we're paying it, because if we pay it, all we're going to encourage is more piracy. And what are we,
Gilad? Reasonable piracy is... Market value piracy is okay.
That's what I'm saying. It's kind of crazy how this whole thing works. But again, halacha, Jewish law says, you ransom. If you see that it's a trend or whatever, or they're asking a high price and it's going to lead to a trend, then you don't. Again, how this plays out emotionally, it's going to be good. But each situation. But here we do see that society is taken into account. So your question then of, wait a second, if I divulge information, is it going to stop people from getting proper medical care and sharing it, as we had the first reason for confidentiality, the first one, quote text 2 or whatever, 2a, about confidentiality, is because that's part of the therapeutic thing for society, if people have to feel comfortable. That may be relevant. Although again, not again, because I haven't said this before, although we don't find in halakhic literature, modern halakhic literature, this argument being used consistently, it may be an argument that one can use against divulging information, even in a more serious situation, because what is it going to do for the bigger picture? All right, that's it. So that's it for today, and really for the course. Just to recap briefly, I know we're at the time, we're after the time. Today we looked at genetics and the issue of patient confidentiality. We compared the secular approach to the Jewish approach. We found that both systems, with regard to medical confidentiality, seek to protect a patient's information, yet recognize the need to breach that confidentiality under certain circumstances, for example, when another party is at risk. There are gray areas when a person is diagnosed with a genetic disease that has no known cure, when there seems to be no definitive preventative action that can be taken. And yet, Jewish law will consider additional factors, for example, if the children are not married, how that will affect the perspective of the prospective spouse, or maybe perhaps the desire or ability, whatever, not ability, the desire or the perspective on having children of even the married children. But nonetheless, we explained right at the end that there's no obligation for physicians to incur financial liability to protect others from potential risk that is not life-threatening. As far as WikiLeaks, mentioned it before a few times, Jewish law would forbid it, unless you can point to a clear need, an individual that needs the information, and then you can only be leaked to the individual that needs it. Can you blast it out there? Now that it's in the public domain, so the New York Times says, well, it's already public anyway, and it's in the public interest.
It gets to the public. So,
but it was a theft that began it in a legal act.
There's two separate sins. One is stealing the information, one is
publicize.
Question is, would it fall under, would the times halakhically fall under the prohibition of rechilus lashon hara, whatever it is? Would it fall because it may be considered to be public knowledge already? You have the issue of furthering the issue of theft, but do you have that isser, that lav, that prohibition of gossip, slander, negative talk, etc.? May not be. But certainly the idea of the public needs to know. Whistleblowing has been going on for years and politicians have not been straightening out. So there's certainly no belief that this will finally embarrass them enough to get down the straight and narrow. I don't think this is going to do it. Anyway, thank you all for coming out to Medicine and Morals. I hope you enjoyed it. It's been a wonderful journey.